Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You're listening to a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello, this is Jared Watt, the producer of the podcast. This week, Finbar and the team are talking about Taiwan. Now, recent US diplomatic visits to Taipei have angered Beijing, which considers the self-ruled island part of the Chinese mainland's sovereign territory, and that any American overtures are meddling in domestic affairs. Now, as Finbar says, on with the show.
Hello and welcome to the China Geopolitics Podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham, the Europe correspondent at the South China Morning Post. It's been a week of escalation in the Taiwan Strait, with Joe Biden dispatching an unofficial delegation to Taipei to meet with the government in a sign of his support for expanding the relationship. At the same time, China has warned once again that this is a red line. Military build-ups and incursions in airspace are becoming the order of the day. It's a worrying situation. Who will blink first? John Carter and Joe Shin will be here to discuss the historical significance of Xi Jinping's aims to reunify China, as well as the economic angle at play. Taiwan is the world's most important producer of semiconductors. We've also seen economic data for the first quarter of this year out of Beijing on Friday morning. John is going to talk us through that in his usual forensic detail. Then in the second part of the show, we're going to be talking Belt and Road Gone Wrong with Matej Szymalczyk, the executive director of the Central European Institute of Asian Studies based in Bratislava, Slovakia. This week, again, we saw top officials from the tiny Western Balkan nation of Montenegro, not yet an EU member, but a prospective one, go cap in hand to the European Union to ask for a bailout on a near $1 billion loan it received from Chinese lenders back in 2014. This is to build the first stage of a highway, but the EU has said no way. With an estimated cost of $23.8 million per kilometre, the highway is thought to be among the most expensive stretches of road in the world. It's not even finished yet. The first repayment is due in July, and we're going to discuss a worrying debt pileup potentially on the EU's Balkan border and how Brussels views China's efforts to grow its influence in this part of Europe. Let's get on with the show. Joined as usual by political economy editors John Carter and Joe Shin to discuss the week's events. And there really is only one place to start this week, and that's in Taiwan. Just a quick run through some of the headlines we've had in what has been a really busy week with regard to this situation. US President Joe Biden dispatched an unofficial delegation to Taiwan on Tuesday in what has been seen as an aggressive show of force towards Taipei. They will meet with senior Taiwanese officials at Biden's request. These are long-term friends of Biden and senior statesmen who are also close with Taiwan. We also had a story this week from the Financial Times, this one, that Japan's President Suga is in the White House this week to meet with Joe Biden, where he will be pressured to make a joint statement on Taiwan in response to rising Chinese aggression in the Indo-Pacific. Combined with that, the military aspect of what we've seen this week, the Chinese People's Liberation Army flew 25 warplanes into Taiwan's air defense identification zone on Monday. This is the largest incursion yet. We also have seen on Thursday, Chinese military beginning live fire drills in waters off Taiwan's southwest coast. John, this is a bit of a dangerous and perilous situation. We've obviously seen tensions flare from time to time in the region over the past few years. Where do you rank this in terms of you know, its scale?
Well, it's a bit difficult to say yet. You recall that in previous presidents, the Chinese government has tested them. You remember that the observation plane that was shot down in the early days of George W. Bush's administration and the pilots and the other airmen that from that plane were held in Hainan Island for a couple of weeks before they were released. That was in the very early days of that administration, and maybe this is the same testing that's going on. A Taipei newspaper reported that the Chinese have incurred in Taiwanese airspace in 86 of the 104 days so far this year, up till Wednesday, when, as you said, they had the largest incursion yet. And so this is China testing the limits, and whether they go farther or not remains to be seen. But the Biden administration is pushing back. Mm-hmm. You recall last Sunday, Blinken made very clear that there would be consequences if China were to attack Taiwan. He didn't say what the consequences would be, but at the time I thought it was a fairly unusual statement by Blinken to come right out and say, now hang on, China, wait a minute and think about what you're doing. And maybe they thought they knew something, or maybe they thought they needed to warn China before it went too far. Because it's not just the Taiwan issue. You've got the issue with the Philippines, South China Sea, the East China Sea with Japan, a number of issues simultaneously. And so now Biden has sent this special delegation headed by former U.S. Senator Chris Dodd and two deputy secretaries of state. So while it's technically an unofficial delegation, it has two government officials in it as headliners. So it's Biden sending a clear message. We are friends with Taipei, with Taiwan, and if China were to attack, we would respond in some way. How and in what measure remains to be seen.
Yeah, it's interesting because you mentioned the previous tests that Beijing has made of previous U.S. administrations. I don't think we've seen a situation where both sides have been engaging in such brinkmanship, certainly not in recent memory. There was also something I might add, the viral photographs that were doing the rounds of U.S. Sea and a Navy captain with his feet up, saying yes, that he's watching a Chinese naval vessel.
Very popular pictures, yes.
We're
watching you. And it was by design. The U.S. Navy did this by design. Mm. It's called cognitive warfare. We know what you're doing. We're watching you. So be careful.
Careful is an important word. It does seem as though this is brinkmanship, Joshin. It's both sides ratcheting up the pressure. This is the sort of thing that could quite easily spiral out of anyone's control.
Oh, yes, Fingba. I think for China's perspective, China is trying, reunification with Taiwan is something that cannot be negotiated. China dream, including a complete China, at least from the Chinese government's perspective. So when President Xi Jinping or any Chinese leader is going to declare that China has achieved its national rejuvenation, China cannot afford seeing the mainland and Taiwan are still separated. How can you call a great nation when your country are still separated? And this is a strategic direction. So that's why I think the Chinese government, for all these decades, never promised that they will give up force as a means to reunify with Taiwan. It's still kind of mentality is we will do it at whatever cost. So this is a kind of strategic choice, and it's not to be easily swayed by one administration or one leader. And as John said, there has been flashpoints many times over the Taiwan Straits, but every time it's kind of solved peacefully. The last time when it seems that the cross strait war is going to happen was in 1996. But we also have to remember, by that time, China's military power was dwarfed by the U.S. military presence in the region. 5 years after the first Gulf War, China's navy was saying it's compared to the U.S. ones, it's from a different, basically from a different century. So China has no capabilities of having this conflict or rivalry against the United States. But today is different. If you look at, as John mentioned, if you look at the Chinese military aircraft, if you look at these cruises, China is to give the impression, we can do it at any moment, at any day. It's just by our own choice. If we want to take Taiwan back or attack Taiwan today, we can start it and finish the war within like 48 hours. And they want to have this kind of uh, um, uh, impression also for the United States. And for sure, like one important factor deciding the timing of China's action will be, you know, the Washington's determination, how committed Washington is in protecting Taiwan. So if, I mean, for China, if U.S. also have an all-out war against China, maybe the cost is a little bit too heavy. But if the U.S. saying this is just another regional battle and we just engage and then quickly retreat, and then this is something that China can, you know, can swallow. So, yeah. But at the end of the day, I don't think there would be imminent, I mean, risks of war, because for both sides, they're saying time is on their side. For China, President Xi Jinping already said the momentum and time is on China's side. China will only become stronger. The relative gap with Taiwan will be wider, economic, military. So China can wait. You know, China can wait for another 5-10 years, no problem. But for the United States, of course, there was no need to provoke, you know, Taiwan to start any, declare any formal independence to start a war in the Taiwan Strait. So for now, I think the risks are still manageable.
There's been a lot of talk, Joe Shane, over the last few years about how Xi Jinping's elevation to, you know, Deng Xiaoping level of, in terms of eminence as a Chinese leader, Mao Zedong. And a lot of people say that maybe in order to elevate himself to that, you know, upper echelon, particularly with Mao, it would take the reunification of Taiwan with mainland China. I just wonder if you could maybe explain a little bit about that point of view, coupled with the fact that this is the 100th, this year is the 100th anniversary of the Communist Party, and how those historical and perhaps symbolic factors are playing into the situation with Taiwan.
Okay, Finbar, if you go this way, I suggest you go a little bit longer even. Throughout China's thousands of years of history, all those names will be remembered as the great emperors or great generals, you know, whoever can unify the whole country under the same heaven will be remembered. But by that said, that doesn't mean that there will be, rush or there will be reckless actions from Beijing to do this. The 100th anniversary of the Communist Party is more of like building up domestic consensus, rallying the whole country, the whole party, you know, on the same page about that China is on the right path, China is on the right side of history, the time and the momentum is on China's side. Also remember, Finbar, you know, for this 100th anniversary of the Communist Party, there was no military parade in front of the Tiananmen Square. So China wants to project this image that 100 years after, you know, the Communist Party is still peace-loving party, political force, and it is not trying to threatening the world peace, world development. And for Taiwan, it is a sovereignty issue that the Communist Party has to solve. But the Chinese Communist Party is not going to any war like very easily. So this is a message. I think for this year, at least, I don't think there's any possibility that there will be a big military conflict over the Taiwan Strait.
Yeah, there's, of course, economic factors here. China is trying to work its way up the value chain, technologically. Taiwan, one of the biggest chip makers in the world. The United States at the moment is on a chip making drive, pumping billions of dollars into its own domestic industry. John, can I maybe ask you a little bit about how that supply chain factor plays into this and how important Taiwan is in the global supply chain there?
Well, TSMC is the premier chip maker in the world. They have the best, highest quality chips. And it would be difficult to imagine the world doing without TSMC at this point. I mean, there are the competitors are Samsung and South Korea. But you may have noticed this week the Biden administration banned work with seven entities related to Chinese supercomputing. And within days, TSMC canceled orders to supply chips to those entities. And so TSMC is working within U.S. Political parameters, and this will not make Beijing happy. So you could make an argument that's one reason for Beijing to invade is to get TSMC's technology. But it is important. I mean, as you know, China is trying to move up its value chain to be independent in chip making and other high tech products because it's badly dependent on the US, on the West now. That's where Taiwan is kind of in the middle. On the one hand, they do supply a lot of technology to the mainland. There are lots of connections business-wise between Taiwan and China. On the other hand, it leans towards the United States because the United States is the unofficial protector of Taiwan. And so they're caught in the middle, and the whole chip episode is an example of this.
Jiuxin, I bring you in on this. How strategically important do you see that technological and the sort of innovation element of this story?
Well, I think John mentioned a very interesting theory that China has one more reason to attack Taiwan because TSMC. But there's a different view that, you know, the existence of TSMC is actually one reason for China will not rush to attack Taiwan, because TSMC, as John just mentioned, is critically important for producing basically all the advanced chips for not only the region, but also for the whole world. So many, you know, before Huawei was sanctioned by the U.S., before the last August, you know, Huawei can design chips, but the production is made in the fab, in the foundry at TSMC. So it is very, very important for China's semiconductor industry as well. And China, mainland China and Taiwan have all those kind of close economic relations. And if you look at SMIC, you know, China's best chip manufacturer, although it is being blacklisted by the United States, but its key executives, its key researchers are from Taiwan, and they are the former executives of TSMC. You can see from this example that China actually can learn a lot and gain a lot from prosperous or booming semiconductor manufacturing business in Taiwan. So yes. So, but at the end of the day, as you also know, Biden has this week has basically conducted a meeting with all these 19 semiconductors executives as well as automakers, you know, to talk about this chip shortage. Apparently, everyone is seeing that TSMC as a company has been too, you know, the burdens or the responsibilities on this one single company is just so big that it's almost affected the security or the sustainability of the global value chain. So everyone, every country, including China, the United States, even the European Union, they try to say, okay, this is not a very stable way. So we have to build up, you know, fabs as well on the American soil, within Europe, within Chinese territory, so that reliance on TSMC can be reduced a little bit. But these kind of projects, these kind of plants are so expensive to build. I mean, so and it also take a long, long period, at least several years, for this plant can actually be, you know, produce any chips. So for the time being, or at least in the next 1 or 2 years, the importance of TSMC on the landscape of global semiconductor industry will only become more important, not less important. So anything happened around the TSMC would have had a ripple effect on the whole global industry. Yeah. For instance, if there's a blackout, and then it's on headlines of all the industrial websites, because, you know, a blackout at the TSMC is huge, or there's a drought, or there's a flood. So everything happened at the TSMC will have kind of repercussions or implications for the whole world. So these anecdotes are going to show how important TSMC is at the moment.
Yeah, this is why they call it the most important company in the world. We're going to be hearing a lot more about this in the future. Just to close out this part of the show, John, I wanted to ask you about the economic data, which has just come out this Friday morning. We've seen a record year-on-year quarterly growth in the Chinese economy, 18.3% compared to the first 3 months of 2020. That doesn't really tell the full story, though, does it, John?
No, it doesn't. The 18.3% growth figure is compared to the first quarter of 2020. when growth contracted by 6.8%. So it's skewed by that low base. Many analysts are focusing on the quarter over quarter growth rate to see what's really going on in the economy. And that slowed from a revised 3.2% growth rate in the fourth quarter to only 0.6% in the first quarter. Number of reasons for this. We had the spike in coronavirus infections in northern China. We had unseasonably cold weather. We, of course, have the Lunar New Year, which even seasonal adjustment factors never fully account for. So there's reason to believe the 0.6 is a bit understated, but still that is what's going on, is the economy slowed in the first quarter. And so the question then becomes what goes on from here. So some economists think that the growth will rebound in the second quarter based on what they see happening in March alone. But others are saying, okay, now growth is leveling off. It's rebounded to its pre-coronavirus level, but the growth rate is starting to level off and will slowly taper off as the year progresses. And some even believe that Chinese growth will fall below the U.S. growth rate starting in the third quarter. So yeah, we're looking at a gradual decline for a couple of reasons for this. First, China is clamping down on lending to the property sector, one to control housing prices, another just to cool things off a bit, because they're very concerned and have been for some time about high debt. The other reason is that the government wants to taper off its economic stimulus that it put in place a year ago in response to the virus. So the PBOC, the central bank, is likely to not add as much liquidity to the economy going forward as it has before. And we already know, based on the figures that were announced in March from the National People's Congress, that fiscal spending, in other words, government spending on various projects, will be lower this year than it was last year. Not massively lower, but still lower, with the idea, let's gradually reduce this extra help we've been giving the economy up to now. So we'll see. To remind, the government's growth target for the year is over 6%, quote unquote. Now, just about everybody and his brother is forecasting that growth will be above 8%. And even some economists today, based on the first quarter data, are revising up their growth forecasts to higher above 8%. So most forecasts now are between 8 and 9%. For instance, the IMF is at 8.4% for this year. But again, that's based in part on a very strong early part of the year with a slight gradual tapering off through the year, with the growth rate perhaps falling to the 5 or 6% annualized rate by the end of the year.
Yeah. John, can I just ask you the difference between what the United States is doing in terms of the unbelievable levels of stimulus they're pumping into the economy and what China's done? Just maybe for the listeners who haven't heard you discuss this before, why hasn't China gone as, you know, all guns blazing as the US has? Is it a product of the sort of their respective viral situations? Is it a product of China being more confident in the underlying economic situation?
Yes, to both of those. I mean, they were first off the square to get coronavirus under control. They were first to have the pandemic hit them. And so their recovery started earlier. And because they really clamped down early on the lockdowns in many places in China, their economy rebounded faster than expected, and so they didn't need as much stimulus. And as you've reported, the trade figures have been astoundingly good, in part because Europe and America are importing a lot of stuff from China related to the coronavirus, personal protection equipment related to fighting the virus, as well as work-from-home equipment like computers or home stereos or what have you. That is likely to taper off. Another reason to expect slower Chinese growth going forward, because the U.S. is getting back on its feet now, and hopefully Europe will too, and so their production will rise and won't need as many Chinese imports. But to go back to your question, the U.S. is lagging China in economic recovery The U.S. has not done a nearly as good a job in controlling the virus as China has, and so it needs more economic stimulus. Plus, there's obviously a political dimension to U.S. stimulus plans. The thinking in the Democratic Party of Biden and his aides is that one of the mistakes that President Obama made after the global financial crisis was not going bigger in terms of economic stimulus. And the Democrats got crushed in the first by-election after Obama became president. And part of that, they believe, was because there wasn't enough economic stimulus to make people feel good about the economy. And so voters blamed the Democrats and voted them out of office. And so this time they're going big. They're going real big. I mean, you've had in December, you had the $900 billion stimulus, and then you had the more than $2 trillion stimulus so far this year. And then now you have Biden's new infrastructure program with a couple $1 trillion more in stimulus. So all of this is going to goose the U.S. economy. And as I say, many expect U.S. growth to exceed that of China starting later this year for a period of time. I think over the longer period, Chinese growth will still exceed U.S., but less so than it has in the past.
Interesting stuff. We'll wait and see how this plays out. Europe, that definitely doesn't seem to be anywhere near the scale of the United States in terms of stimulus, and definitely nowhere near China in terms of recovery either. So it seems to be falling between the cracks of the two.
Indeed. Now they are talking about doing more, and you saw the European Central Bank increased its monetary stimulus, but the fiscal stimulus from Europe has been tied up in bureaucracy and really hasn't gotten off the ground. And as you say, their vaccine rollout program has just been just inundated with problems. And so the virus is still a big, big issue there. Lockdowns still exist. And it's going to be a while, maybe next year, before they really get off the ground.
It's a terrifying thought, but fascinating as ever. John Carter, Joe Shin, thanks a million for joining us today.
As critical news stories emerging from China continue to shape lives and business around the world, the weekly SCMP Global Impact Newsletter brings you expert analyses and insights on the economics of COVID-19, society, technology, and the environment. Sign up to receive your weekly email at scmp.com/newsletters.
Joined on the line from Slovakia by Matej Šimalčík, who is the Executive Director of the Central European Institute of Asian Studies. Matej, thanks so much for joining us on the show. We're here to talk specifically about a highway in Montenegro. It's quite niche, but the big picture is very important indeed. Just as a bit of background, a $944 million loan in 2014 to the previous Montenegrin government from the China Exim Bank, one of the big policy banks in Beijing, was given out to a road project to be built by a Chinese company. Only the first stage of the road project, not even the full thing. This highway will eventually link the Adriatic with the Serbian border. Now, this caused headlines this week because not for the first time, a senior cabinet a member from Podgorica in Montenegro asked for the EU's help in repaying the debt to China. The EU has said no. It said it does not repay loans of partners which they took from third parties. Matej, it's a bit of a mess here on the EU's borders. When we were discussing this earlier in the week, you explained to me how this puts the European Union in a little bit of a lose-lose situation. How do you see this? What are the EU's options, and you know, which is the least worse?
Thanks for having me on the show. The situation we are discussing in Montenegro, it's really quite difficult for the EU. Because if you look on the face of the things, we see that Montenegro, which is one of the prime candidate countries for future EU membership in the Western Balkans, is facing a heavy debt burden from a Chinese policy bank, which it is unable to repay. Montenegro government, and that's the government that is no longer in power, took on this loan despite previous warnings from European institutions that the project for the highway construction is not feasible, that there were two feasibility studies by to European policy banks that found that the project is not economically sustainable. Nevertheless, Montenegro government decided to go with it and took a loan from China to construct the highway. Now, with when the EU is facing this request for helping to pay the loan, it has basically two options. None of those are particularly good for the EU. The first one is to not help Montenegro, which is where the discussion seems to be heading for now. And that would leave EU with the possibility of having a bankrupt state directly on its borders, and actually a state that was the closest towards the membership of the EU from the host of Western Balkan countries. Also, it would provide EU with a very bad messaging towards the Balkan countries, which are already kind of fatigued with these ongoing long-term discussions about prospects of membership not really going anywhere, and EU not will not willing to help them would only reinforce this image that membership is something that's not really going to happen anytime soon, and that could drive them further into the arms of China or Russia or any other power that's willing to meet their financing needs and infrastructure needs as well. The other option, which is not really particularly good either, is actually helping Montenegro, which would probably help EU to secure better visibility in the country and in the rest of the Balkans. Nevertheless, it would also send the very troubling message to the other countries that EU is willing to step in cases whenever they take on risky loans from China, and it might reinforce this kind of behavior towards the future when they see that there are no possible, not really any big ramifications for them, as others would help out if things turn sour.
Yeah, so there's, I mean, those are not great. And not a great hand, you know, deck of cards that the European Union has to work with. I want to ask about the broader situation with China here. You know, there are accusations of debt trap diplomacy in China's defense. The embassy in Montenegro this week pointed out that the loan has an interest rate of 2%. But as we've mentioned in the introduction to the show, this is one of the most expensive stretches of road in the world, regardless of the interest rate. I think it's the size of the loan, perhaps, rather than the interest rate, which is the real crippling aspect for Montenegro. Is this an example of perhaps a previous government being more friendly towards China and the new government not being along those lines? How much blame do you apportion to China for giving this loan, perhaps for a project which maybe should not have happened in the first place? How much blame should you apportion to the previous government in Montenegro? And, you know, China obviously gets a lot of flack for these sorts of things, but I mean, it certainly takes two to tango.
It indeed takes two to tango, and the Montenegro government is really bearing a bulk of the blame, because it's not like they were not warned previously that the project is not feasible, and they decided to go with it anyway. At the same time, China bears some of that responsibility as well, because if it wants to posit itself as a responsible stakeholder in international affairs and international development, it should not be going around supporting these kind of projects. It shows also another interesting dynamic that China is really trying to play the role of the Plan B for countries in the Western Balkans when they are unable to secure financing from Western financing institutions, and it's willing to take on this kind of risky project. It might be interesting to look forward in the future whether China has learned from this episode as well as others around the world, because certainly when these projects come into these problems, it does not create very good optics for China as well. And it can also have ramifications for China in the Western Balkans, because if you look on, at these warnings that were issued towards recipient countries in the Balkans, the risks were, I think, for most stakeholders, quite abstract, because there wasn't really a clear case where they would manifest in the region before. Now we have first such case in the Montenegro, and the things are not looking very well for Montenegro. So it may be this kind of turning point for some countries in the Western Balkans to think more about the potential risks of accepting loans from China. And maybe they will change their negotiating strategies via these loans or try to work with other financing institutions as well, just for the sake of diversifying their options.
Sure. China has been quite successful in building a relationship with Serbia, neighboring Montenegro. Obviously, during the pandemic, we've really seen this come to the fore with the provision of PPE, masks, so on, testing kits, all the rest. And now in this latest stage of the pandemic, we've seen Serbia be, you know, very, very supportive of the use of Chinese vaccines. You know, they have been, as I understand it, opening their borders to people from neighboring countries, including Montenegro, to come into Serbia and giving out vaccines for free, including Sinopharm, the Chinese vaccine. How important is that Serbian-Chinese relationship in understanding the dynamic of China in the Balkans in general, Matej?
The Serbian case and Serbia's relationship with China is really a special case when you look on the entire Balkan region. With Serbia, you have a country that has a quite negative view of, for example, its relationship towards the U.S., due to the past NATO intervention, which obviously is still remembered in the country and acts as a catalyst of positive engagement with Russia as well as with China. In any case, these days we see Serbia engaging in a sort of a hedging strategy where it is trying to balance its interests against all four major players in the region, that being the EU, US, China, and Russia, and playing them in sort of way against each other to get the best possible deal out of that. Yeah. So while we've seen, for example, engagement with China on the mask diplomacy and vaccine diplomacy, nevertheless, we've seen recently that Serbia was willing to sign a 5G security memorandum with the US administration, and that was Trump administration at the time. So it's really this kind of a balancing exercise for them. Still, Serbia has been one of the countries that have received the bulk of the attention from China from out of this entire 17+1 format, which puts together China with the countries from Central and Eastern Europe. The investment and the credit flows to Serbia were one of the highest from this entire region. Mm-hmm. And since China has been investing in these high visibility projects like railways and other types of infrastructure, that obviously creates a very positive image for China, despite the fact that when you look on the actual numbers, you will see that, for example, EU pumps it into the country much more money compared to China, and it faces a really big visibility problem in the country.
Yeah, this is a big issue that the EU is very careful to point out to me every time I ask them, is that they're the biggest funder to Montenegro, but also to most of the other Balkan nations, both in terms of investment, in trade, and in support financially across the board. And I wanted to ask you, Matej, we on the podcast before, we've discussed the 17+1 and perhaps how it's not monolithic, how each of these countries have their own problems and their own issues and their own relationships and outlooks on China. I guess history has told us as well that, of course, across the Balkan nations, there are very different policy opportunities, policy priorities. And generally, I wanted to ask you, do you see a sort of patchwork of attitudes towards China among the Balkan nations as well? Or is there a sort of uniform trend that you can point out there?
I'll start maybe with explaining what the 17+1 format is a little bit. It's this kind of loose grouping of countries from Central and Eastern Europe that was started in 2012, when you had 16+1 actually only. And it started with this kind of regular annual summits of prime ministers. 2 years ago, Greece has joined the club, and since then it's known as 17+1. But really, if you look on the countries that are present there, you have a mix of EU member countries, non-EU countries, countries from the Baltics, from the Visegrad region, and from the Western Balkans as well. And these countries actually don't really have that much in common, just for the fact that they are all post-communist countries. which makes this format a little bit cumbersome, I think, for all parties involved, including China, because it's very difficult to find any kind of uniting factor that would make it into a more coherent platform. Yeah. So even though it looks like a multilateral platform on the first sight, when you look deeper into that, it's really a collection of 17 bilateral relations that run yeah. parallel and often compete with each other. And of course, all these countries have very divergent interests, especially when you compare those that are members of the EU with those that are not members of the EU, as well as very different perceptions of China. And the perception has been really changing quite a bit in the past 3-4 years in light of what has been happening in Hong Kong and in light of the pandemic as well. Still, if you look, for example, on Serbia, that's one of the few countries where you see that the sentiment towards China is still very positive and yeah. Really actually improving over the past years. But overall, in the region, you will see mostly the opposite trend.
Yeah. Would you put Serbia and Hungary in the same basket? Because obviously I'm reporting this week on EU action on Hong Kong next week, which we're going to see on Monday. Hungary holding it up as usual. Is Serbia as far along in its relationship with Hungary, or would you say maybe not quite to that extent?
They're somewhat similar, but also there are some differences, actually. So with Hungary, you have a government that is obviously very strongly China-friendly and yeah. is using the relationship with China also to hedge against the EU in these ongoing discussions about rule of law violations in Hungary, which and possible sanctioning by Brussels. But when you look into the country on the level of the population, you will see that the Hungarian population is far less enthusiastic about China compared to Serbia, for example. So there you have a quite a big difference. With Hungary, this positive engagement with China is really centered on a single political party. And in the future, if a political change would occur in Hungary, that might very well lead to also a change in the entire country's position on China. And we've seen that, for example, in Slovakia after last year's general election, that after 15 years of being dominated by the government that was quite China-friendly, we see now a government that's really wary of China and is looking much more into the potential security risks of that cooperation. And it's quite vocal on the international scene as well when it comes to human rights issues as well.
Yes. So
this issue of domestic political change is really something to look out for in all the countries in the region.
All the countries in Europe, I think, well, certainly some of the big ones. We're going to see a big change in Germany, perhaps later in this year as well. Some of the CEE countries as well. We're going to be having to keep a very close eye on this, Matej. So we'll definitely have you back on to discuss as things develop. But for now, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. And it's been a good to chat with you again.
Thanks for listening to this week's China Geopolitics podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham. We'll be back here next week with more of the top news from this part of the world. In the meantime, tune in to scmp.com for all the latest headlines. Follow us on Twitter at SCMP Economy. I am at F Birmingham, and we'll see you next week. Until then, stay safe, wash your hands, wear your mask, keep your distance. All the best.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to scmp.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.